As we continue our exploration of the theorists of mass and scale, today I'll be tackling a thinker that I've written on in a best-selling book, The Populist Delusion, which has an entire chapter on Samuel T. Francis, who has a much thicker book called Leviathan and Its Enemies. Francis was a conservative or a so-called paleo-conservative in American politics. He wrote a newspaper column for many years until he was cancelled for various different reasons. Back at the birth of cancel culture, he's somewhat been reclaimed, dare I say, by the American right since then. But he is a very interesting thinker, not least because, before we get into him, I'll make myself big again. He was one of those people who was not scared of looking at the thinkers of the left and looking at the thinkers of the right and coming up with various syntheses. And like me, he had read his elite theory, but he had also read his postmodern deconstructionist types. He'd read Antonio Gramsci. He had read Bernays. He had read all of these theorists of mass communication. He had thought deeply about ideology. And Francis, I think, did more than anyone else to bring that sort of material back into the main line of what I would call elite theory. So in my view, Francis actually stands in the main canon of elite theory, and he did the necessary work of bringing, I guess you'd call the cultural turn in Marxism, or the, you know, thinkers like Gramsci, Althusser, and so on. He brought those back into consideration. Also interesting for Francis is that he may be one of the first thinkers that we've looked at who explicitly aligns himself with the bourgeoisie. And I'll get more, and what he really wanted for America, a revolution, what he called the revolution from the middle, a reassertion of bourgeois interests, which also makes him kind of interesting after looking at so many Marxists in this series. Before we get going, I'll remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency if you're really interested in all this stuff. Foundations of Politics is a great one to get. There's Foundations of Economics. There is the Trivium, which is the bestseller, Foundations of Shakespeare, many other great courses. You know, I calculated that if you bought the Ultra Bundle, which puts them all together and, you know, can get it for £999.99, fantastic price, you can get all those courses in one, and you end up getting each course for a huge amount of money off. I think it's like a third off every course if you buy them all together like that. So the Ultra Bundle, if you want to get them all, save you money in the long run. Anyway, let us have a look at Francis. So he really picks up from where James Burnham left off and recognizes the managerial regime. Most Western societies are governed by a managerial elite, a distinct class that operates through interlocking bureaucracies, corporations, universities, media, NGOs, administrative state. This class rules by expertise and institutional control, displacing both the traditional bourgeoisie and their ownership, and as per the analysis of James Burnham, and the popular democratic mandate. So this is an elite minority in the true oligarchic sense, and they run society like many other minorities through history in their own interests, and they're in the interest of expanding their own power and control, and not in the interest of anybody else. And Francis had a problem with this, as we all get on to. One of his most famous concepts is that of anarcho-tyranny. In the managerial state, the basic enforcement of social order is refused. So most governments all through history saw it as their duty and obligation to uphold law and order, that is, to defend against foreign threats, external, you know, the protection of the external border, and to defend against the internal threat of criminals and vagrants and so on. Instead, the managerial state basically tolerates crime, vagrancy, social breakdown, drug taking, whatever, because it's not really concerned about upholding that social order. What it's much more interested in, as per George Orwell's 1984, is aggressively regulating the conduct of the law-abiding middle class, the tax base, the cash cow that keeps the engine running. So the anarchy part of anarcho-tyranny is the fact that a lot of crime just isn't, you know, a lot of law enforcement just isn't enforced deliberately by the government. And in fact, this was an observation that, talking of George Orwell, there was another book, Clockwork Orange. Many of you will have seen the film or read the novel by Anthony Burgess. Now, in A Clockwork Orange, again, they were much more concerned with thought control and the kind of regulation of the middle class than they were of, you know, dealing with crime. And Anthony Burgess explicitly based that novel on stories that he'd heard and read about and researched in the former Soviet Union, where apparently in the Soviet Union, they kind of let a lot of petty crime go because they weren't interested in that. What they were interested in was fealty to the party. Now, whether all this is true or not, I don't know. You'd have to kind of do your own research. But the basic idea is that the managerial state here in Britain or over in America, where Francis was talking about, kind of lets things go to wreck and ruin. That's the anarchy part. Okay, the street level hood never really sees justice. This kind of softness towards disorder and harshness towards the compliant coexist as a structural feature of the regime. It's not an accident. The purpose of a system is what it does. It is by design. And this is anarcho-tyranny in a nutshell. So Francis's concern really was with middle America. He saw the middle American, the middle class, the tax base being squeezed. The regime, the managerial regime, as per the analysis of Bertrand de Jouvenel, who I will do a video on at some point, but the high-low middle mechanism keeps a kind of underclass as its pets, really, as its clients, right? So the managerial regime likes to keep clients, and it keeps those clients passive and under control by giving them little gifts, okay? And by not enforcing social law and order on those various groups, kind of turns a blind eye to them because they are useful as a kind of mechanism of control. But it continuously hits the middle class who, you know, get a lot of that. You know, the very rich get tax breaks. The very poor don't pay any tax. But everybody in the middle is, you know, the people who actually work and, you know, do the 9-to-5 muggins, basically. That's all of us, by the way. Most of you watching this will be in this bracket. Most of us who, you know, stupidly will pay. If I get a parking ticket, I'll grumble, but I'll pay it. Right. If a police officer came, said, hey, you over there, I'll be like, oh, shit, I'd probably cack myself and be like, all right, officer, I'm here. OK, unlike many of those members of the underclass talked about by writers like Theodore Dalrymple. Right. Unlike many of those or Hitchens, I would just kind of comply as a dutiful member of this kind of middle class here, okay? And Francis was saying, like, these are the people who end up getting screwed over, by this managerial regime. The managerial regime is almost like a kind of vampire sucking on these people, but it also does nothing for them. It's parasitic on Middle America. So that's why he wanted Middle America to kind of have a revolution from the center. And in many respects, this is what MAGA was supposed to be. This is what MAGA people, you know, hoped represented. I think, you know, Paul Gottfried, who's still around, you know, his original conception was that this, you know, MAGA would be the fulfillment of the promise of the revolution from the middle. It would make America great again. And if you have a look at the breakdown, everybody thinks of MAGA as being, you know, poor or trailer trash or something like this. This is just a kind of liberal snobbish stereotype. Most MAGA voters actually pretty well off, you know, if you have a look at the income brackets, whereas the liberal, the Democrat vote has bifurcated. It's got the very poor, in fact, exactly the people who's the managerial regime. It's the very poor, the kind of client class who are kept through gifts, and the very rich who have the luxury to have these sorts of liberal beliefs. Whereas everybody in the middle, you know, is kind of ends up being resentful of the whole system. And that is the energy, right? That is why 70, 80 million people voted for Donald Trump. Now, of course, he let them down, but that's a story for another day. The primary constituency for resistance to the managerial regime is what Francis called middle American radicals, the broad middle strata squeezed between the corporate elites above and the subsidized underclasses below. They feel dispossessed on every front. They see their culture under attack. They see immigration as a direct assault on their livelihoods. They see the general neoliberal economics as, again, a direct assault on their bank balances. And they see a general erosion of national identity. And the radicalism of this squeezed middle is a reaction to displacement rooted in the lived experience under the managerial state rather than an abstract ideology. And Francis aligned himself with this radical middle, and he hoped, as I mentioned, that they might take back control. The elite, the managerial elite, has severed its cultural and social ties to the historic nation with its core population. It has become globalist. Its loyalties run towards a professionalized network that is equally at home in London or New York or Tokyo or Hong Kong or Timbuktu. It doesn't really matter where they are. As long as it's got air conditioning and a Starbucks, they're just at home. Okay, people talk these days about the laptop class. Well, you know, and to be fair, I had my taste of being one of these myself, both when I worked in the city and I was doing conferences all around the world and meeting, you know, people who worked in banking, and when I was an academic. You know, I give a paper in Chicago and this, maybe I'll be in Rome, and maybe it doesn't really matter where you are because the inside of a hotel is the same everywhere. Famously, David Goodhart called these the anywhere people, the anywhere people. The managerial elite are recognizably made up of anywhere people, no particular attachment to any particular place. So the loyalty of the managerial elite, this globalized managerial elite, is to each other and to that sort of person. And the managerial elite kind of sees the person who stays in the hometown as kind of a little bit sad, a little bit to be looked down upon, a little bit parochial, a little bit kind of bigoted even, to be disparaged. Basket of deplorables, you might say. The managerial elite has fealty to abstract humanitarian values, which speak to the kind of tastes and preferences of the managers, and of course to fellow managers. The people it nominally governs receive no such allegiance. You know, going back to Elul, they are a problem to be managed. A problem to be managed. Their tastes, their wants, their discontents, a problem to be managed out. Or to be, maybe their perceptions can be, maybe we can pull it this way or pull it that way to make things appear to be other than what they are. Elite detachment is a structural precondition for managerial rule, as Francis treats it, and a product of deliberate cultural drift. And again, I may get to Christopher Lash one day, but this is something that Francis echoes. There's a book called The Revolt of the Elites by Christopher Lash, talks about this phenomena of the detachment of the managerial class from everybody else. The cultural revolution comes from above. What presents itself as organic change is, according to Francis, systematically engineered. Okay, and this is a theme that I have hammered on this channel. So many of the things that look like they came from below were actually engineered from above. And one of the great things, I think, about Samuel Francis is that he was fearless in, let me just pull myself up here. Samuel Francis was absolutely fearless in stomping on sacred cows, sacred liberal cows, on just piercing through the absolute guff that you see in the media. One of his famous essays is on Martin Luther King and Ronald Reagan's abject betrayal of the Republicans, really, in making Martin Luther King Jr. Day an actual day of national celebration. Back in the time when political correctness was still kind of getting going, Francis didn't care about telling the truth about a figure like, you know, Martin Luther King. And in that essay, he says, look, what you're seeing here is almost a kind of quasi-religious. It's symbolic. All of these things prefigured what we saw, for example, in the Summer of Love and BLM and all of that stuff. You could look back at Francis and say, well, he was sort of a prophet. He saw, you know, the woke coming, you know, before, or he saw them in their proto state and spoke very powerfully about them. But even more important than his kind of cultural commentary is the fact that Francis points out that almost all of this stuff was done from above. It was orchestrated. The consent for it was manufactured. And in the history of this video, some buddies of mine in America, and Aaron McIntyre and various other people, we basically exposed the fact that there was this internal U.S. government department called, I forget what it's called now, but it was basically a bunch of, CIA adjacent or FBI adjacent offices, cultural department that basically made sure that these cultural revolutions went off without a hitch, that it was, in fact, Martin Luther King and not Malcolm X, for example, or that, Bob Dylan at the Washington Monument there in 1963, that it all went off as it was supposed to. So when we say from above, we quite literally have the receipts at this point showing that when we say deliberate, literally deliberate and orchestrated, to the point where there's a government department just making sure. In fact, Elon Musk, in his brief time involved with politics, showed us many, many other receipts as well. That the US aid budget, for example, that went, or, you know, was involved in basically funding many, many different NGOs, many different so-called charitable organizations, and also involved in just making sure that these kind of cultural things from below go off in the way that they wanted to. I have another book here. Maybe I'll do a whole video on this book. Who Paid the Piper by Francis Stoner Saunders, which shows just how much of kind of European and American cultural life since the Second World War was directly orchestrated and funded specifically by the CIA. When I read this book, it blew my mind. One of the things that blew my mind was the fact that one of the Svengalis behind the scenes, one of the people orchestrating things, was James Burnham. Literally, James Burnham himself was the CIA director in charge of doling out the money for these various cultural causes, which is really quite something, because we know that James Burnham did not believe in liberalism, did not believe in democracy. And yet there he is, manufacturing a fake center left and a fake center right all across Europe and all across America. It's just mind blowing. This is the sort of thing that if you told me this like 20 years ago, I'd be like, you know, where's your tinfoil hat? But the receipts are all there. They really are. And the more we found out, the more it's kind of jaw-droppingly. I mean, the thing is not people talk about the paranoid style, right? And Alex Jones and all this sort of stuff. The fact is, it's not the paranoia of the ruled, right, of the normal people that is remarkable. I think the remarkable thing is the paranoia of the ruling class themselves, how little they leave to chance, how micromanaged so many of these things that look organic are. It's like what they themselves have basically no faith at all in the people or in organic processes or in nothing is left to chance. And so when Francis says cultural revolution from above, he means all the way. Media conglomerates, universities, philanthropic foundations, which are often fronts, by the way, for intelligence money, and HR departments reshape norms, language, and identity through deliberate design, entrenching the conditions under which managerial authority is legitimate and unchallengeable. And this is something else that I find kind of interesting, is that the managerial regime doesn't like alternatives being left on the table. And if there is an alternative on the table, it must demonize it. It must destroy it, even, or paint it as extreme, or paint it as unpalatable, or, you know, constant hit jobs in various different ways until it is either so marginalized that it has no chance of coming into being, or it's completely vanished. That is a distinct feature of the managerial regime, which, you know, when I say it's totalitarian, it's a soft totalitarianism. You know, they won't literally line those people up against the wall and shoot them in the back of the head like Stalin would have done, but they will use every other means. And we've seen those means utilized, you know, debanking and deplatforming and, you know, attacks on reputation, or, you know, media destruction in various different ways. Those people will be targeted and brought down if they are genuinely trying to offer an alternative to what the managerial regime has deemed acceptable. Francis sees a decline of national sovereignty. Transnational structures are favoured by the managerial elite. They like supranatural national organisations, trade bodies, courts, NGOs that bypass national democratic accountability and concentrate power in technocratic hands. Now, here in Britain, nothing embodies this more than the various bureaucracies of the European Union, which is why so many of those people in the middle were for Brexit, okay, is because there's a kind of distrust of the technocratic manager, and people can kind of tell, well, yeah, that EU thing, that seems that that's it, it's like it's them, you know. Mass immigration, large-scale immigration, which is, in Francis's view, a deliberate strategy of the managerial state, weakens the cultural coherence and political solidarity of the historic nation, reducing its capacity to mount organized resistance to managerial power. If you think about the classic trade union, that was always undermined by bringing in workers from elsewhere. So if there's mass immigration, that weakens the individual power, weakens classic labor power in the Marxist sense. I think that's an underrated element of mass immigration as a kind of punishment. You can think of, in this country, the miners and the workers held the country to ransom in the 60s and the 70s, then came Thatcher. And then after Thatcher came mass immigration. Well, you could see mass immigration as the ruling class's punishment of the workers. Never try this again. Yeah, in fact, you can't try it again because what are you going to do now? You're outnumbered. Or we can just hire this dude from over here and this dude from Sri Lanka or this dude from India or etc. And we will fill the mind of the left, the people who should actually be taking up these courses, these causes, with so much bunk, with so much of this managerial guff that they'll even support it as it's happening. And Francis sees the erosion of peoplehood, the old nation state, and the historic people identified with that nation state are systematically disaggregated, leaving individuals atomized and dependent on managerial institutions. Now, one of the things that Francis spends a lot of time talking about is ideology. Now, I've already done various weeks on, the techniques of propaganda and mass communication and of ideology. But he, quite rightly, I think, places great emphasis on this in his analysis. It's somewhat underdeveloped, you might say, in the work of James Burnham and in the original elite theorists. Mosca does have the idea of the political formula, and Pareto, does talk about the need for these myths of legitimation. But the tendency is to say, well, this is just some BS that needs to be told or whatever. Mosca does give quite a lot of power, I would say, to the people's kind of beliefs, right? He's got a whole bit on that. But you could argue that in the 100 years since those guys were writing, we've seen so much more of this in the age of, technique, as Lewell would call it, in the age of propaganda, in the mass media age. You can't really ignore the role of ideology. And there's a reason, it's not an accident, says Francis, that the ideology of this managerial regime is one of equality, diversity, human rights, and progress. Because all of these things function as the legitimating vocabulary of the managerial state itself, of the managerial regime. These ideologies serve a dual function. They disarm opponents by rendering their objections, their just moral, political interests, you could say, as morally indefensible. We've all seen it. You're a sexist, you're a racist, you're yada, yada, yada. You're a fascist, you're a Nazi, blah, blah, blah. Okay? this basically is just used as shorthand to demonize anyone who would go against what the managerial regime wants. And secondly, they justify the endless expansion of administrative and regulatory power. Think of the massive expansion in codes of speech and the regulation of speech that has come about purely as a result of the fact that the managerial state imported millions of people who are foreign to a particular place. That comes with its own host of inevitable problems that could be predicted by anyone who's even had a glance at history. But in this circumstance, the managerial state turns around and says, well, the problem is not the problems we've created. The problem is the reaction of the people. That is the problem that must be managed. So if, for example, the street on which you grew up is no longer recognizable and you feel upset or unhappy about that, the problem is you. You're the problem. And in fact, I remember going to many liberal kind of academic conferences in America and Britain, and I'd hear that phrase quite a lot by various kind of progressive types. They'd be like, oh, you're the problem. You're the problem. The problem is not the problems that have been created by this regime or by this state. It's your reaction. How dare you have a problem with the fact that the street you grew up with is no longer recognizable? You're a bigot. You need to be regulated. In fact, action needs to be brought against you. And we'll come back all the way to anarcho-tyranny. And you might be saying, well, hold on a second. They're wrecking this place. Hold on a second, Deirdre. She wouldn't be called Deirdre. She'd be called something like Morgan. Hold on, Morgan. Okay? You know, when I was growing up, this street had standards. People painted their fences. Now there's a brick through the window. Oh, well, you have to be accepting of, you know, the different kind of cultural sensitivities of the new arrivals. The problem is you. That's a very patriarchal response. Yada, yada, yada. We all hear these arguments. The failure of conservatism, another big theme in the work of Francis. He wrote a whole book called Beautiful Losers. Conventional conservatism has been rendered structurally impotent, according to Francis, by championing free markets, deregulation, and existing institutions. It defends the very mechanisms that concentrate power in managerial hands, whilst abandoning the cultural, demographic, and communal interests of the middle Americans it claims to represent. In other words, the Republican Party, or the conservatives here in this country, were agents of the very destruction that conservatives now decry. This has been a point also made by Peter Hitchens about Margaret Thatcher. And this was the difference between the paleoconservatives and the Reaganites, the split Francis was aligned with people like Pat Buchanan, Mel Bradford, Paul Gottfried, and people like this, who, you know, didn't necessarily have any great love for the free market types. Because think about it, capitalism is a kind of corrosive acid, but it also creates the conditions for all of these things. It builds up the infrastructure and creates the conditions for the mass immigration, you know, the so-called Rust Belt, the deindustrialization, the financialization, etc. And remember, this critique is coming from the right. And this is another thing that creates an issue, because if the right is entirely defined by its love of the market as happened under Thatcher and Reagan, it gives the left a kind of monopoly over or ownership over opposition to the excesses of capitalism. Politics, political conflict is ultimately about power and the interests of concrete social groups rather than constitutions, free markets, or universal moral principles. Francis was trying to get conservatives to understand elite theory, banging his head against a brick wall, as I found out to my own chagrin. More than a decade or two after Francis was writing. They're just never going to get it, Sam. They're not going to get it. They never will. Even the people who say that they get it still don't get it. So, you know, it is what it is, I'm afraid. Appeals to abstract principles, Francis argues, routinely obscure the real stakes. A struggle between an expanding managerial class and the middle strata it displaces. Principles divorced from group interests become instruments of mystification rather than liberation. What Francis is saying in a nutshell is, look, you have to be absolutely open about the fact that you're speaking for middle America. Who am I speaking for? My group. Not this universal principles, my group. My strata of people, the ones who've been getting screwed over by this system. It's about us. It's not about this principle or that principle or this moral or that moral. It's about me, my family, my interests. Conservatives can't think in that way, really. And paradoxically, despite the fact that the left also have their share of humanitarian platitudes, the groups of the left tend to be a lot more particularist in that way. Hence the Black Caucus in Congress, or this Native American group for my rights, my people, or, you know, Latino Americans for whatever. This is a point that has been made over and over again by Tucker Carlson, who in many ways you could argue is the inheritor of this tradition of Francis. Although I would argue that Tucker probably could do with reading some more Samuel T. Francis, but you know. Francis argues that there's a very strong need for counter-organization. He insisted that the effective resistance to the managerial regime demands more than electoral politics or principled dissent. It requires the construction of new forms of solidarity, organization, and collective consciousness among the dispossessed middle strata, oriented towards reclaiming power on fundamentally different terms. And for all of this, what happened to Samuel T. Francis is that he was shunned, cancelled, and jettisoned from polite society and kicked out of the Republican Party and sacked from his newspaper column and cast out. That's what happened to Samuel T. Francis for speaking along these lines. In other words, the Republican Party said, Samuel, it sounds a little bit like you're going against the managerial state here. Not really happy with that because guess what? We're part of that, buddy. So, you know, which is basically the fate, has been the fate of anyone on the right who starts talking in these sorts of terms. That is indeed it for Samuel T. Francis. So I would strongly recommend his book, Leviathan and Its Enemies, is about that thick. It's a big book. I've got it over there. I'm not going to go and get it now. You can pull it up. I still think it's available on Amazon, what it was. Maybe I should check to see if these books are available. But I strongly recommend you know, after you've read my chapter on Francis in Populist Illusion and watch this video, you know, he is somebody to explore. Beautiful Losers and Leviathan as Enemies, I would say, are absolutely required reading for anyone who's got left or right, who's got an interest in, you know, the political struggles of our time. It may be that Francis's dream of a revolution from the middle was a pipe dream, that various structural reasons mean that the middle, the kind of people of, you could call them kulaks, right? The people of reasonable, independent wealth, not super wealthy, but, you know, they do well enough, squeezed in the middle. But they're a very difficult group to coordinate and to get everybody on the same page. It's hard to get solidarity of that group of people, which is why they're kicked around by all the other groups. That group of people, too big, too disparate, too mass, you could say. Maybe one day I will have a look at The Logic of Collective Action by Mancor Olson, another great thinker, to analyze exactly why this is. Why is that middle strata so easily kind of led around by the nose and so difficult to coalesce into a coherent special interest group? Okay, unlike, for example, the Black Caucus or, you know, Latino Americans or whatever else. There are reasons. But that's a story for a different day. Pick up courses at the academic agency, you know, as I pick up my pen. And I'll catch you all next time. Bye, everyone.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.